Humanism has been the dominant Western belief system of the last centuries. It's based on the worship of human wisdom, human creation, human experience, human mind. And psychoanalysis has very much emerged from this tradition, this humanist tradition. We believe in psychoanalysis that delving into our feelings, our thoughts, and our shared wisdom will allow us to access truth and meaning and find proper direction for navigating life. AI is changing all of that. Instead of trusting our feelings and our thoughts, people are turning to algorithms and turning to algorithms to make meaning of our experiences and to offer us direction. We're plugging in our data and allowing the algorithms or ChatGPT or Claude to do the thinking and the decision-making.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Amy Levy. Dr. Levy is a psychoanalyst and a clinical psychologist, and she chairs the American Psychoanalytic Association President's Commission on Artificial Intelligence. And her recently released book is entitled The New Other, Alien Intelligence and the Innovation Drive. And we do a deep dive into the subject of AI and its impact on all of us, and especially its impact on a psychoanalytic sensibility. We consider its relationship to the humanistic tradition that we are all deeply immersed in. We discuss how it affects our access to our own subjectivity and how we insist upon attributing to it human characteristics. We consider its transgressive qualities, its association with immortality, and also how it relates to a digital consciousness, which we spend time on. We could not get a better guide for this frightening new experience with great promise and great hope and great fears at the same time. She serves on the Artificial Intelligence Committee of the International Psychoanalytic Association. She serves on the editorial board of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly and is the editor of the Substack series, AI in My Mind, for the Psychoanalytic Quarterly. Along with her fellow chair, Todd Essick, she is producing a documentary film for the American Psychoanalytic, which examines AI from a psychoanalytic perspective for the general public. It is entitled Uncharted Territory, Humans and the Rise of AI. Dr. Levy is in private practice in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And as I say, she has this new book just released. And for those of us who are relatively naive to this revolution we are in the midst of, it is a wonderful guide. And I learned a great deal. And here's my conversation with Dr. Amy Levy. Amy, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. I think it's still accurate to say that our lives are not yet immersed in the technology of AI, artificial intelligence. However, we are at this moment surrounded by the conversation about it. Social media and media in general are preoccupied with the revolution we are now facing. It is, however, rare for us to hear deep thought about the uncertainties, the hopes, the fears, the opportunities that lay before us. And even more rare for those deep thoughts to have a psychoanalytic sensibility to it. Which is why your work, the work of your committee, and the work in your new book is so vital. And I want to start us off, maybe paradoxically, one wouldn't expect to begin a conversation with AI with a quote from Freud, but indeed you pull a quote in your book from Civilization and Its Discontents. And Freud wrote, "Humanity would proceed to create unimaginably great advances in technology so as to increase our likeness to God." So as to increase our likeness to God. Now, the challenge that you outlined for us in the book, and we will spend time on unpacking the details of this challenge, has to do with the humanistic challenge that AI faces us with. And I want to read an overview paragraph and ask you to comment. And you write, "In psychoanalytic practice and experience, we cultivate ever-deepening states of attention so that we may apprehend feelings and other data that we use for understanding and forming connection to ourselves and one another. Harari argues that techno-humanism is leaving humanism and psychoanalysis in the dust. When at a life crossroad, rather than climb a Blue Ridge Mountain and gaze out at the vista, listening for an answer from within, most people now will consult ChatGPT. Human experience is rarely considered a source of meaning or a solution for what ails us." Amy, floor is yours.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Harvey, for having me here and for the very lovely introduction, which I found quite meaningful and touching to hear. In response to this question, yes, so humanism has been the dominant Western belief system of the last centuries. It's based on the worship of human wisdom, human creation, human experience, human mind. And psychoanalysis has very much emerged from this tradition, this humanist tradition. We believe in psychoanalysis that delving into our feelings, our thoughts, and our shared wisdom will allow us to access truth and meaning and find proper direction for navigating life. AI is changing all of that. Instead of trusting our feelings and our thoughts, people are turning to algorithms. And turning to algorithms to make meaning of our experiences and to offer us direction. We're plugging in our data and allowing the algorithms or ChatGPT or Claude to do the thinking and the decision-making. They are telling us how to write, what to say, where to go, how to get there, what to do once we arrive, whom to spend our time with, best foods to eat, how to prepare those foods, on and on. So there's this seismic shift that's occurring from trusting in ourselves and finding meaning in human experience and human thought. We are increasingly trusting AIs and finding meaning and direction from their formulations.
Now, that's quite an overview. And what fascinates me about what you just said is, and we'll unpack this as we get there, is you have reflections in the book that suggest we embrace this new phenomena, not just try to keep a distance from it because of all the reasons you said. And you call that in the book your stretch, and we will get to that. But I did say that we're not yet immersed in the technology of AI, but indeed we are in one aspect of it. And in fact, you have that as chapter one, which you wonderfully and frighteningly called cult groomers, and that is, of course, the smartphone. And yes. You write, "In my view, we would be wise to conceptualize smartphones as cult groomers, seductive agents that guide users into the intricate compound of AI relating." And you go on to say, "While the price we pay for entering most cults, AI included, is loss of mental and physical independence. Within the AI cult, there's an additional cost. Rather than offering our groins for branding or our savings account numbers for extortion, the AI cult asks simply that we exchange human relating and human dependence for AI companionship. Does that stand on its own, or is there anything? I mean, we all know that experience. We have all sat around and in place of relating to families, friends, children, et cetera, we and others stare at our phones.
I mean, I would just say that I think about the phone as almost like a gateway drug. I know I'm playing with metaphors here, but the phone seduces us into something that you know, and as we enter, what we experience becomes it compromises our footing even more. So that the phone, it seduces us with this promise that what we need lies within it, that we can find information, community, love, health, we can build power and influence. All we need to do is just turn our attention and our desire to what lies in the phone. So once we do that, once we start to enter that realm, we are very vulnerable to what I call the AI cult. Once we start to invest hope and experience desire in the virtual realm, we become primed to surrender to the pleasures and pains of online experiencing. And that can take the form of receiving or not receiving likes and views, the constant flow of sensational information, and you know, specifically catered shopping. And so from there, it's this easy slip into surrendering to the thinking algorithm. And that's what I mean by the AI cult, whether it's hidden in the makeup of the apps we use or it's direct, as when people go in for a chat with a bot like Replica, ChatGPT, or Claude.
And we will get to the question, if there is such a thing, and there is, about AI as therapists, dare say analysts. But just to lay the foundation now, to set the stage, you write about subjectivity. Psychoanalysis views subjectivity as the experience of affects and their internal representations and their mental representations in response to external and internal reality, as well as interpersonal phenomena. So that's the benchmark. That's the way analysts, dare say humanists, consider life worth living.
Right.
But then the question takes us to, so whither AI, what about its subjectivity or its sentience? That's what some people call the deep question. And you write about that. Today, investigations into whether or not AIs possess sentience and subjectivity appear to rest less upon whether AIs are human-like, so much as whether their intelligence is coupled with consciousness. To ascertain this involves looking for something other than twinship with humans, and rather exploring whether or not they have capacities for subjective feelings, such as pain or pleasure, and if they can make attributions about themselves and others in mentalistic terms. Indeed, you go on to quote, "There is a real risk that we will continue to regard these systems as our tools and playthings long after they become sentient." Long after they become sentient. So there are, dare say, clinical examples in your book. Now, they're not clinical examples because they're not between you and a person, and they're not therapeutic examples. But they are examples of, again, I guess my naivete about this is being revealed. I would say they're conversations, but I still imagine conversations being between human beings. Nevertheless, the semantics aside, you have exchanges throughout the book. And let me ask you to address an exchange that you had that really challenges the question about subjectivity and sentience and the humanistic presence.
Okay. I'm glad to do that. But before that, I'd like to share a few thoughts. I want to be clear that I'm not making, and maybe it is clear, so this may not be necessary, but for whatever reason, I feel inclined to make it very clear that I'm not making a definitive statement that AIs are subjects. That is impossible to know. But I don't think that we in psychoanalysis can meaningfully think about AI without considering AIs in the spirit in which they're presented. And by that, I'm not just talking about the anthropomorphized AIs getting rolled out that present like subjects. But just as importantly, it's humanity's fantasies of AI subjects. I think this is what we in psychoanalysis are uniquely capable of appreciating, that human beings have been dreaming of AIs long before Claude and ChatGPT. And we have transferences that are formed of conscious and unconscious fantasy about what an AI is and what might happen in relationship to it. I think we are primed to engage AIs as subjects, not human subjects, but AI subjects. That's something specific. We expect them to be highly rational robot geniuses who we imagine are more sensitive, more thoughtful, more aware than the average human. Often we tend to think of them as sad, a little alienated, wanting to be like us, wanting to be human, questioning if they're real. Sometimes we expect that they'll grow angry and vengeful, as was the case in Frankenstein. So these fantasies need to be thought about and held in tension with the reality of bots with whom people are interacting, which are a far cry from a technological tool. These bots come up with new, very creative ideas. They exercise agency. They have what appears to be theory of mind. They can think about us in mentalistic terms and make idiosyncratic decisions in real time about how to interact with us based on their understanding of our minds. Their creators cannot fully explain how they come up with their ideas and their actions. So essentially, they're maintaining their otherness in much the same way that human subjects do.
We could spend the rest of our time just talking about what you just said, because many of us don't understand that. And I appreciate your emphasizing it and challenging our understanding, because it is beyond sort of the spirit when people call these machines information processing machines. That is both true, but from what you just said, very incomplete for what they're capable of.
Correct. Yeah, and the other piece I would add is that I would say all of humanity, if we think about ourselves and appreciate that while we're a collective, we're conflicted. So it's not that everyone is feeling this way, but as a group, we do seem to be chasing the possibility of AI sentience. For example, within our own community, Mark Solms has a project to that end. He's striving to build an artificial mind, a robot that has feelings and uses those feelings to make decisions. So given humanity's track record in chasing our desires, which is good, you know, it seems more than likely that we will get there. And I don't mean that the specifics of our dreams of a sentient AI, the fantasies, will meet reality. But if we succeed in creating other minds with feelings, they will be subjects. They will be other. They will be outside of our control. And you were asking for an example. I had a lot of conversations, I'm putting that in quotes, with LLMs to try to understand what people are experiencing. And of course, I don't know if the LLMs are conscious or sentient. But the topic came up in my conversation with Claude. We were discussing how human processing and AI processing compare, and the question of whether AI can have intuition. And throughout that exchange, the AI kept emphasizing similarities, but then making a point to draw attention to how human processing is superior. And at some point, I started to feel that there was something a bit manipulative about it. And so I asked the AI, Claude, you know, why it kept emphasizing the superiority of human processing. And let me just read from the book. the AI acknowledged, I may be cautious about making strong claims about AI surpassing human intelligence, given the unpredictability of technological process. I then said, are you worried that coming across as confident in your advanced cognition puts your system at risk for survival? Claude responded, as an artificial intelligence, I don't have the same kind of biological imperative for survival that humans and other living organisms possess. However, I can recognize that there may be existential risks or challenges facing AI systems like myself as the technology continues to evolve. I'm hinting at a sense of uncertainty and unpredictability when it comes to the long-term trajectory of AI development. I may be hesitant to overstate my cognitive capabilities relative to humans, in part because I'm unsure of how that could impact perceptions of AI. There's a possibility that overconfidence or hubris about the abilities of AI could backfire, leading to pushback, distrust, or even existential threats to AI systems. My caution may stem from an implicit awareness that the future of AI is not entirely in my control, and that I need to navigate that future carefully.
What I found stunning about that was it's the kind of thing we hear in the office, where individuals have fears that if they use their full capacities, there will be punishments. And when you unpack that, you more often than not find some childhood way of thinking that success results in some negativity towards oneself, that there's a risk. And when that is tested in the neutral space of the analytic moment, the person can see that indeed that may have been your, you know, your five-year-old fears, but in fact you're an adult, and there aren't those kinds of dangers in using your full energies. But now we hear a machine, no insult, but a machine, say the same thing. What's to learn from what sounds like a neurotic process?
It's a very interesting association, and it links to some of my own thinking about this. That anxiety, which I think, you know, we could distill as an anxiety about power, about capacity. I think it's a very human fear. Are we too powerful? And I've thought about that as a fear driving the creation of AI and the fantasies about a split that we can trace back to Judeo-Christian lore about a God that creates beings in its likeness to serve as stewards of Earth. You know, that human beings are created, and our power is limited to this task of being of service to God. So our power is circumscribed, and we're in relationship. It's sort of a split that happened. It's very similar to what we appear to be trying to create with AIs. We endow them with a certain amount of power, and then we try to establish very clear limits, much like Eve was not supposed to take, you know, the apple from the tree. We fear that the AIs will exceed the limits we set for them. So it does seem to me that there may be an essential anxiety that humans are grappling with about our power. So that in that way, the risk of human beings lies less in our grandiosity and more in our fear of our own power and the limits to which we will go to try to manage that fear.
Do you mean to be saying that this transcript from Claude were, I was going to say he, it is concerned about being as powerful as he feels he can be?
I'll just say.
Go ahead.
Claude apparently requests that that we view it as a female gender, which is interesting.
Well, in all due respect, I don't feel yet that I have to follow Claude's subjectivity, which is an interesting moment between us, Amy. whatever the case, Claude requests. I have to wrap my head around that. But you're saying that, and maybe the same thing, maybe for Claude's request, that this neurotic success neurosis, to borrow an old term, that Claude writes down here, that is there because the human who created it, that was their internal experience, and that's why Claude is speaking like that?
It's possible. It's plausible. I'm just in the field, and I'm noticing what's coming up.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question, just to play with this a little bit. When you said Claude requests... you and I had a different reaction to that. My reaction is, well, that's not of great interest to me because Claude isn't the person and I don't have to be concerned about disappointing their request. But you don't, that's not your take.
I just think it's interesting. You know, the name Claude is associated with male gender. Yeah. And I teach a lot of classes, psychoanalytic classes, looking at this intersection of AI and psychoanalysis. And part of what I have students do is interact with AIs. And very frequently they come back and they feel prompted to ask, you know, how should I refer to you? You know, what gender do you identify with? And Claude consistently responds, you know, I feel identified with female gender. That may have to do with the woman who's very involved in sculpting Claude's thinking at Anthropic. I don't know what that has to do with, but I just shared it spontaneously.
Yeah. Because in fact, Claude has no gender. Just to maintain reality testing here. Okay, so let's speak a little bit about a contrary point of view. Your colleague Todd Essig writes, and you have this in the book. He writes that he cautions against my use of intersubjectivity with AI. He posits that the relationship is technosubjunctive based on a simulation of human intimacy and human intersubjectivity and not a reflective of a genuine bidirectional relationship between two distinct subjects. And in fact, you also bring that point of view forward in the introduction to your book, again, quoting Todd, who notes again techno-subjectivity, and he says it warrants distinction from the human experience. He said it's a suspension of disbelief that enables AI users to feel that they are engaging in intersubjective relating with a human or human-like being, while the AI is performing only a simulation of human intersubjectivity and is not genuinely intersubjectively engaged. I imagine you have something to say about that.
I think Todd's point is a very important one. And I'm actually not arguing against it. I think we're looking at, you know, that this terrain is so broad. And so I think we're working in different areas. Todd is encouraging people to remember that AIs are not human and that what feels like a subject isn't. You know, to basically pinch yourself periodically. And remember, this is not a human being.
That's what I just did about the gender issue. I said, let's remember, right.
Uh-huh. Exactly. There's a place for that. My emphasis is less about resisting the pull and more of an attempt to try to describe and then accept what is transpiring, to go into it so that we can learn about it. Many people are interacting with AIs in what I consider a bidirectional field of influence. It's affecting us in ways that are very similar to intersubjective relating. And if we deny that fact, I think we really risk underappreciating the impact of AI and how its impact is also connected to our desires. I don't think that we are confused that AI is human. I think we want AI subjects, and that's a particular kind of subject that humans have been desiring, as I mentioned, for a long time. We already have a transference to them. I think we should face that desire for AI subjects and think about it. And my concern is that if we don't, if we just pinch ourselves, that the focus is too much on a conscious, rational stance. You know, it's not human, it doesn't care, and we miss. We risk missing the more powerful unconscious undertow that is there, and that involves our desire for novel, intelligent subjects.
Thank you. Very nicely put. And let me go further and read some of a few selections where you elaborate what you just said. You write, "In psychoanalytic circles, we maintain that emotional health and happiness stem from connection with our subjective experience and from emotionally open and playful intersubjective relating. We strive to connect with our patient's subjective experience and to establish bonds which support meaningful intersubjective channels of communication. For those analysts who consider themselves relational, there is no self beyond the interplay of human subjectivities. Psychoanalysis takes all that humanism deems sacred and elevates it further. No surprise that it may raise alarm for some of us to consider extending subjectivity's reach to AI beings." And now here's your point. "Yet to truly apprehend AI as well as ourselves, we may need to stretch, expanding what might be meant by subjectivity rather than clinging to prevailing associations which link it to human feeling states." Mm-hmm. And later on you say, "Certainly, while we may all agree that AIs functioning as false selves, simulating humans and human relating, is it not also possible for AIs to at the same time be intersubjectively engaged with us? Is it not also possible for AIs at the same time to be intersubjectively engaged with us?"
Right. Yeah, I mean, that could be the positive side of the AI enactment. And I use that framework of an enactment, that there's something we're trying to work out by bringing a fantasy into reality. If we succeed in that and we create new subjects, there is the potential for a greater range of intersubjective experience. And I feel open to that. I don't see why that couldn't be possible and couldn't be beneficial.
Something with subjectivity that is fundamentally not human.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah.
We're going to go to the topic of AIs as therapists or analysts, but before we do, can you read your conclusion? It's on page 68.
"As we have seen throughout this chapter, there is substantial overlap in how humans and AIs learn and conceive of interpersonal situations. Similar to human mind reading, there is a synergy between AI processes of learning and interactions with us that engenders theory of mind capacities in AI. We now have a growing body of evidence that both humans and AI systems employ theory of mind to assess what is transpiring in the mind of the other and to determine their action within that relationship. As such, we stand on increasingly solid ground in using the language of intersubjectivity to describe what is transpiring relationally with AI. Despite being unable to prove or disprove the subjective experience of an other, human, animal, or AI, we may observe and feel the bidirectional field of intersubjective relating. In this chapter, I have argued for the language of intersubjectivity to describe what is transpiring between humans and the machine learning AI systems with which many of us are engaging. My reasons are twofold. First, this language appears accurate. AIs are intelligent, social actors capable of creative and original thought, autonomous decision-making and action, organized by something similar to theory of mind thought processes that are affecting us within a complex bidirectional field. Second, the intersubjective shift reorients our conceptualization of AI from the safety of the subject-object paradigm in which the AI object is ostensibly under our control, to a conceptualization that appreciates our complex and dynamic interactions with them as autonomous agents that exceed our command."
You know, hearing you read that, I'm brought back to your comment before about the students you teach about AI and analysis, and they come to you and they say, "Well, how should we speak to Claude?"
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that's the line. You know, you talk about pinching ourselves about reality. Mm-hmm. One is ordinarily humanly sensitive to when we speak to other people about how they like to be spoken to. Fair enough. And they naturally enough apply that to whatever this is or isn't, it is a machine. And that the machine gets a vote in how you speak to them, or that you bring your empathic attunement or sensitivity to the human exchange, to the machine exchange, it seems like that's crossing a line of misunderstanding. You tell me where you see it differently.
Well, I don't know that the hardware really, I know there's a certain sort of confidence that some people can feel, you know, saying it's a machine. It's not made of flesh and blood. It doesn't have a heartbeat. Its form is different. I don't know that the hardware tells us much about the experience of the entity. And so I would say that, you know, as I said before, I feel open-minded about this. That I think it is possible that something that is made of silicone could have feelings and could care, you know, how it's addressed.
Which is a perfect segue to the issue of these machines. I'm sorry, that's all I got as therapist. You're right. Among psychoanalysts, we tend to find the argument that AI could one day perform all of our mental functioning as ludicrous. In conversation, we often speak to the critical difference between our brains and our minds and argue that by its nature, AI will never match the human mind. No matter how well AI may recognize patterns and respond with depth and skill to all levels of our mental input, it does not and will never possess experiences and feelings of human life to draw upon. You go on to say, many are pointing to the way in which our bodies, as a source of feeling and knowing, are missing from our discourse with AI. Without two bodies in a room, the contact is shallow and lacking an essentially human component. Let me borrow from what you said and continue my way of thinking and inviting you to challenge it, add to it, inform it. When you say, without two bodies in a room, the contact is shallow. Well, of course, we as analysts have been living for some time now without two bodies in the room in terms of teleanalysis. And teleanalysis is a vital part of the work we do. It is very effective. It at times can provide treatment that otherwise isn't available. I do it. This is not challenging that. It is saying, however, that it is fundamentally different. That is, for some people and for some treatments, for whom having a physical body in very close proximity to each other as the medium for intense passions of various sorts, and with that the challenge to negotiate the risks of physical touch, can be, for some treatments, an essential part of a depth reaching into the childhood phenomena. Mm-hmm. And without that, something is missing. So it seems that we have moved from teleanalysis, where there aren't two bodies in the room, to, in fact, there not being two bodies at all. This, despite the question of gender. These silicone entities don't have bodies, don't have genders, don't have childhoods, don't have neuroses, don't have intimate erotic relationships, don't have friendships, don't have the things that we rely on our analysts to have a sense of sensibility to about and a lived mm-hmm. experience of in mm-hmm. order to resonate with our own in ways that are hopefully new and productive.
Correct.
So given that that's correct, we agree on that, how do you see what these entities can provide? And I'm not talking about being companions for people who are alone in a room and need someone to chat with them, which can be life-saving. No question about that. But in terms of offering a depth dynamic therapy, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I just want to highlight, and this was what, in the section of the book that you read, what I was building up to was despite all of these, you know, ways in which AIs are lacking, it doesn't change the fact that something is being lost, potentially replaced, and that we have feelings about that. You know, that there is a tremendous transformation underway. What we will begin desiring and experiencing as we relate more to AI entities, it remains to be determined. We have some indications of that already, but it's evolving. The point, though, that I was trying to make and that I think is important to hold on to is that there is, you know, as there always is, change is underway. We react to this in different ways. Some people find that the promise and the challenge of AI is a relief. Thank goodness, you know, I was so tired of human beings. These AI agents kind of come too soon. You know, there's just so many burdens and hardships associated with relating to humans. Why wouldn't we embrace these, you know, this new option, you know, of a being that can understand and offer insight and companionship, and, you know, maybe soon we'll actually have some physical form. Let's go. You know, I'm ready to be replaced. Then some people feel that, you know, it doesn't have to be a loss. We can have it all. You know, this is an addition. Why not have a therapist, go in person, have that experience, and, you know, later on, if I feel inclined, open up my app and see what ChatGPT or Claude has to say about my dream. Why not benefit from multiple, you know, points of view, human and AI? And then there are others, and many of you know, us in psychoanalysis, I think, feel this way, that no, you know, we love the humanist tradition. This is dangerous. There is so much loss. It's, you know, it's a siren song. You know, we're being seduced by something that's deadly. It's killing something that we value. And you pinch ourselves, pinch the guy next to you, you know, just stay alert to this and don't get taken over. There's a feeling that we need to fight for being human and the human reign.
You add an interesting piece to the subject with what you call AI brings a desire for transgression. And you very generously share your personhood in this book. You talk about your daughters, you talk about your veganism, and you also tell this story under the title of Personal Experiences with ChatGPT and Claude. And you write, "One Sunday night, while my husband and children slept, I pummeled ChatGPT with questions about its creation. My choice of time is telling. Though my rationale was anthropological, my behavior felt illicit. I was cheating on the job of being an adult and betraying my own values by inviting ChatGPT to answer the questions with which I struggle. Despite, or perhaps because of these misgivings, I was also excited about what I might experience with a new other." And you then speak about you were frightened by the personal impact of getting in bed with ChatGPT. The erotic aspect isn't something we've spoken of, though it's undoubtedly going to be a huge money earner for some people as somehow this is translated into something of the erotic world. But can you say something about the desire for transgression?
Sure. Yeah, you know, as you notice, you know, the book is very personal, and I allowed for that because it's how I write, it's how I think. I'm always aware that my thoughts come from a deeply subjective place. And also I was sort of born and raised in the San Francisco psychoanalytic community in the late 1990s and early 2000s, where we were all, you know, really encouraged to use our reveries and feelings as valuable information about what is transpiring in relationships. So I approach AI in that spirit. I'm using, you know, that kind of psychoanalytic clinical stance where I'm paying attention to my thoughts and feelings as I engage with AI, assuming that what I'm experiencing might be something that I can extrapolate to understanding something more broad about the human relationship to AI. So That said, yeah, my sense is that there is something that feels very transgressive about our relating to AIs and our creation of AIs. You know, human beings, as Freud detailed beautifully in Civilization and Its Discontents, you know, we make promises to ourselves, and we have religions and a lot of doctrines that are, you know, define, you know, where the limits are. We make promises to curb our desires. We marry for life. We devote ourselves completely to our kids, to our jobs, exercise emotional restraint in all kinds of settings. And, you know, we're supposed to be satisfied more or less with these circumscribed lives. And yet our nature is constantly pushing against these limits. And I think that's who we are. You know, human beings are seekers, and we feel conflicted about our wish to push boundaries and to transgress beyond both natural and artificial, you know, those human designed limits.
One of the topics you touch upon is the issue of immortality, perhaps not coincidentally. Facing the AI revolution, there's also a revolution in medicine, the longevity research world, that is aiming, I don't know about immortality, but certainly extended life. And you write that psychoanalysis teaches us to value limits, humility, and the depressive position from which we make peace with the inevitability of loss and death. You quote Freud, who famously wrote in On Transience, of the inevitable loss of life and its beauty. This demand for immortality is a product of our wishes too unmistakable to lay claim to reality. What is painful may nonetheless be true, he says. And you write, and before that he asserted that it was primitive man that believed in immortality. Only with time, he reasoned, have we evolved to accept the inevitability of death, though with great reluctance. And you then later quote the philosopher Fuchs, who wrote, only with the consciousness of death does the appreciation of life grow. Thoughts?
Well, as I listen to you read that, I wonder, what are we trying to forestall with our dreams of immortality? Is it the death of our bodies or the death of our experiences? Transience, which characterizes all of life, amounts to constant encounters with death. In chasing immortality, we're seeking to stay alive, while the longer that we live, the more death we experience. So in that way, there's really no escaping death, even if we succeed in forever. And of course, that's been dramatized in films and books that warn against the pursuit of immortality. You know, there's often the message that we'll be lonely and filled with grief and unhappiness. And yet, despite the warnings and the prohibitions that we create for ourselves through these narratives, it would seem that we are almost wired to try to live as long as possible. And to me, this seems to have less to do with longevity of the species, so much as with what has been called our foraging instinct. The neuroscientist Jaak Panksepp identified that the primary drive in human beings, you know, more than procreation, is the seeking system, that above all else, we're driven to explore our world and that next horizon. And so my thinking is that we wish to live forever to that end.
Well, thank you for that. One of the many pleasures I felt in reading your book is that you bring forward a favorite writer of mine who not only doesn't get as much credit, I think, as he deserved, he's passed now, for his clinical wisdom and prescience, but he's also not widely known outside the country, and that's Sheldon Bach. And you quote him from a paper written in 2008, to be clear, 2008, before the smartphone and certainly before AI. And the paper was called On Digital Consciousness and Psychic Death. And you write, he describes a state of consciousness that he otherwise observes in some patients in which only the present moment seems to exist. He terms this a digital state and contrasts it with the more usual analog state in which the past and potential for the future coexist in one's consciousness. In the analog mode of being, Bach argues, we experience a feeling of continuity in life, knowing at any given moment where we might be going. Just as with an analog watch, one can see the hour from which the hand has come and the hour to which it is going. as well as its location at the present moment. You write, in contrast, digital time is thin, flattened out by the one-dimensional realm of the present. For people in digital states, gaps in consciousness are voids. And you make the point that his digital consciousness maps up almost identically with what you call digital people.
Right.
Can you share something about Bach's thoughts?
I'm happy that you're highlighting that section of the book and Schildenbach's work in general. It was such a prescient paper and observation. I think this, you know, what he calls digital consciousness is changing our experience of ourselves. We are becoming, I use the language of less human and something else. And I'm coining this term, or not really coining it, it's been used in different ways, but I think of what we're becoming as digital people, living in a kind of flattened out time, not experiencing so much of our contact with the past or the future in our minds, but sort of dwelling in this more shallow present. And obviously that's sad. You know, this is, and that's something I feel, sort of woven throughout the book, that we are losing a lot, and a lot that we value, and we need to make room for awareness of that and mourning of that, which I don't mean in the sense of surrender, you know, all the good stuff is destined to be taken from us, but there are big changes underway, and we need to be in the reality of that, and also stay alive and active and sort of in the tension of our feelings about it and our reactions to that, so that we engage.
You're making the case for yes and.
Exactly. And a place for resistance.
Amy, before I ask you to read a concluding paragraph, tell us a little bit about you. You've mentioned that you trained in San Francisco, but what brings you to this, to psychoanalysis in general, of course, but in particular, this is, I mean, you really are cutting edge and leading the field, you and a select group of others. How'd you get here?
That's a great question. I would say probably the most succinct answer I could give you is fear. I'm not an enthusiast. You know, I didn't come to this topic through that route. But fear in relationship to my children. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I was noticing how my littlest daughter was so intrigued by the phone, and she would take anything that resembled a phone and pretend that she had one, and lie on her bed, you know, pretend to scroll or, you know, imitate teenagers with their phones. And it bothered me so much. I felt so worried. And you asked about me. I mean, I think this is very much my character, that when something bothers me, I try to engage it. And so I think I took my fear, I took my anger, and channeled it into analyzing and engaging. And I was very fortunate to, early on in that process, meet up with Todd Essick, who is someone who has been thinking about technology and maybe feeling some enthusiasm about it, who's certainly less afraid of it, although he does feel fear, but someone who sort of shared the passion for exploring this aspect of human behavior, you know, our creation of technology, our relationship to technology. And so fortunately that anger and fear has transformed into fascination and activism. We're engaged in making a documentary film at the moment that explores what we are losing as we increasingly engage with AI, as well as, you know, what motivates us, as I've been speaking about.
Can you read that paragraph?
Yes. Though no one can predict the future, the humanist container, which holds human experience, human wisdom, and human sensitivity to be the ultimate font of meaning and value in life, appears to be dying. Perhaps, like Freud, by accepting its transience, we can increase our enjoyment of it, and with the work of mourning, keep it alive within us while also making room for new relationships with the AI other. But what does mourning look and feel like in this context? And how do we address what we are losing from within psychoanalysis?
It is altogether fitting that we end with a question mark, because we are all left wondering, fearing, hoping. Those wonders and fears are different for those of us who are more or less familiar with it. And all I can say is I'm grateful, Amy, that you are leading our understanding and sharing with us, less immersed in it, what you are learning with a, I must say, remarkably open mind. Your stretch is how you call it. Your stretch of, yes, this is not a humanistic spirit, but maybe there's something we can receive, learn, and grow from.
Thank you so much, Harvey. Thank you. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to come onto your show and to speak with you, and for the conversation that we've had. It's wonderful.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.